Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On this Politics Monday, we look at a political summer like no other because of COVID-19. The summer includes canceled and postponed primaries, political conventions in turmoil, and a president at war with, well, almost everyone. But we start with a political undercurrent too often ignored, but which became impossible to deny this past weekend when protests erupted in every major city in the country, including Charlotte, following the death of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police. We'll be having an hour-long discussion with some of the participants in Charlotte's protests on the program tomorrow, but today we spend a few minutes with two reporters who covered what happened here over the weekend. Ryan Pitkin is editor of Queen City Nerve. He joins us along with WFAE's Claire Donnelly. Good morning to you both. These protests started in Minneapolis, obviously, where George Floyd died at the hands of police, quickly spread across the country. They started Charlotte on Friday night in the Bates Ford Road area. Ryan, would you characterize these as organic and or spontaneous, or were they organized?
Well, the one on Friday night was organized. There's been a lot of different ones sort of around town throughout the weekend, including in the daytime and the nighttime. I'd say the one in Bates Ford was organized by a group of local folks who aren't necessarily regular organizers, and that raised some questions this weekend. But I did talk to someone yesterday who organized that one, and then Saturday there were some earlier ones organized that turned into just sort of throughout the night people growing into the event and turning into more, I don't know, organic situations, and sort of the same situation happened yesterday.
When this started on Friday night, you reported, or you actually tweeted about how 20 protesters gathered around CMPD's Metro division over there on Bates Ford, and you tweeted that one of the protesters told you, "We're not going to protest the way police want us to." What did they mean by that?
It was sort of in a way that they didn't want to ask for permits. They didn't want to ask for permission to do anything. They wanted to make it known that this was not looking for necessarily conflict resolution, but to show that they are angry. And this was the specific people who organized Friday night. I'm not speaking for every protester out there by any means. I'm not speaking for any protester, but as far as the Friday night organizers, they were there to not be violent, but to not be not necessarily come together with police or really try to build a dialogue in any way. And that's just as far as that small group of 20 that started on Friday night. As far as the people who showed up, everyone's there for their own reasons. Some people were discussing things with the constructive conversation unit that the CMPD sends out to these protests. Some people were having good conversations with them. But as far as the people who organized Friday night, they just wanted to be there to show they were not interested in resolution. I wanted to ask
you about that approach that CMPD took, because in the beginnings of Friday night's protest on Bates Ford Road, you reported that Metro Division officers were outside the station talking to individual protesters on an individual basis and asked if they'd like to talk, and then they had some officers out there trying, I think, to walk with the protesters as their march began. How would you rate the effectiveness of this approach by CMPD? Did it have an impact?
Not horrible. Every night, every day, these people were working 20-hour shifts, and that was last night at around 9 o'clock, and it still was far from over last night when I was me and my business partner, Justin, had seen someone who was working 20 hours and hadn't gone home. And he's part of this 20-person unit, constructive conversation unit. And a lot of times, you know, throughout the night, they would begin to get shouted down and sort of be replaced or go behind the lines of riot police. But in the beginnings, I've witnessed probably hundreds of constructive conversations going on between protesters and police. And, you know, everyone out there, like I said, is there with different views on the subject. So they're out there to sort of reach the people they can and answer the questions that they can. And They're all the same people. I think 8 of the 20 were out there very consistently this weekend. We saw the same faces every night, every day. They definitely were able to reach plenty of people. So I don't think it was necessarily a failure by any means.
Eventually, things did get a little dicey on Friday night. And we're going to move through the weekend, but on Friday night, things escalated a little bit. There was damage done to some patrol cars, windows broken out at the police station. I think a police officer's bike was stolen and dismantled. How long did it take for things to escalate from what you witnessed at the very beginning to when that began to happen? And why did it happen, given the fact that we had police officers trying to keep things calm and voluntarily talking to these protesters?
So that was probably not until right around when the sun started going down. And it could go either way as far as there was definitely some escalation by police. There was tear gas at a time when me being out there didn't feel like that was necessary. There were pepper balls, which are little paintballs filled with pepper spray. And that sort of escalated things very quickly. People did come out on Friday. It turned into sort of a, I don't know if you want to say organic or just people coming from the area and just enclosing on this area. And they were outraged. It was the very beginning of these protests in Charlotte. People hadn't had a chance yet to vent, and they came out there and were ready to show that they weren't going to be, they weren't just going to stand down from this.
You mentioned that on Friday night and perhaps throughout the weekend, there were people, individuals who were not your normal protest organizers involved in, if organizing is the right word, in organizing this event.
Right.
And people around the country, commentators and reporters around the country and leaders around the country have pointed to, quote, outside agitators, unquote, people who just make it their business to come in and stir the pot. But on Friday, some protesters you spoke to blamed any escalation on white people setting up black people. You quoted one person saying, "Every time I see something flying at the police, it's some white boy in the back who threw it. Then the police gas the black people standing up front or arrest one of them." And you also say that at least one member of the Boogaloo Boys, that's a right-wing extremist group that promotes violence, was in the crowd on Friday night holding an AK-47. Have you spoken with police or civic leaders or community leaders or protest leaders about whether they suspect that this escalation was organized by outside agitators or right-wing forces?
I don't know that the escalation necessarily, I mean, I can't speak to it. I haven't looked at more in depth. I've been covering the protest up until after midnight last night, but I plan to report on that today a little further. But I will say, I don't know if the escalation was necessarily planned as much as it was just anecdotally. You did see a lot of that, especially on Friday night, as far as just some of the white folks who had come out to and were throwing bottles from the back. I mean, I can agree with that quote, and I saw it happen a lot. Now, by no means throughout the weekend were only white people causing damage, but you did see it a good bit, and you saw it a lot. And as far as those right-wing groups like the Boogaloo Boys, that's sort of a new thing. I've covered activism in this year in this city for 10 years now, 12 years, and I've never seen this sort of presence of these sort of anti-government folks who all wear patches, and you can sort of see them. They look military-like when you see them, and they're yelling F the government as opposed to F the police, and they just really stand out in the crowd, and that's sort of a new thing for me to have seen, and it's been very interesting. They're definitely organized online and things, and they say that they're there because the basis of their group is that they support violence against police and they support unrest like that, and they're looking to escalate just as far as their point of being around.
Claire, you were nodding as Ryan was talking. Claire Donnelly is here from WFAE News, and did you notice that when you were out covering this on Saturday?
Well, I just wanted to jump in to say, actually, my colleague Andos Helms did look into some arrest records from, I think she only went through Saturday, so it wouldn't include people from yesterday. But she did find that 31 of the 45 people that had been arrested did have local addresses. Now, we don't know necessarily if the people without local addresses maybe just hadn't changed their license yet and just moved to Charlotte. But I do think that that's worth noting that when they're talking about outside agitators, you know, it doesn't seem like the numbers necessarily bear that out.
The mayor on Saturday, along with George Dunlap, who's the chair of the county commission, declared a state of emergency throughout Mecklenburg County and the city of Charlotte. What did that allow them to do, and what was the impact of declaring that state of emergency?
So it did allow for them to, if they want to, impose a curfew. As of today, I don't think that there has been one imposed. And the city of Charlotte has continuously tweeted, you know, there is no curfew. We haven't imposed a curfew yet. But that is something that they could consider doing. And we have seen many, many cities across the U.S. do that.
There has been criticism nationwide leveled at leadership, that the leaders of various cities and towns and states have not made themselves readily available on the front lines. In some cities, police chiefs and sheriffs got out with the marchers and talked to them individually and made comments. Mayors got involved. How would you characterize the leadership in this town?
Well, I mean, we do know that Mayor Vi Lyles was at one of the protests during the day on Saturday, one of the rallies. And Ryan, I'm sure you were there, but so she was at that one. I have not seen. I know Christy Puckett, a local activist, and also Braxton Winston were both out on Friday night. Ryan, I'm not sure if you know if they were also out, or they were also out on Saturday night. I don't know if Braxton Winston was out on Saturday night as well. Braxton Winston
he wanted to come, and he had some better advice from one of his friends that I spoke to that told him not to come back out after being arrested Friday.
Right.
The only other elected leaders we saw, I think Larkin Eggleston was at yesterday's peaceful rally in the beginning of the day, and then State Senator Jeff Jackson was out all night last night.
So on Saturdays, when things got a little dicey, things were fairly peaceful yesterday, but although there was some damage done yesterday, but on Saturday it was reported that Discovery Place and King's Kitchen Restaurant, which helps underprivileged people out with jobs, also 204 North Kitchen and Cocktails, 5 Church and Sophia's Lounge, all suffered what is called extensive damage. What do we know about that damage?
Go ahead, Ryan.
I'm not very familiar with as far as the extent of the damage as of right now. I mostly only saw broken windows, but I know that some of the restaurants were looted for their liquor is what I've heard.
On Saturday, protesters converged on I-277, blocked it for a while. Police arrested about 30 people, I'm told, and at one point Saturday night's protests were described by police as a riot. Is that how you would describe it, Claire?
So I do think we were talking a little bit before we came on here, but I think that there is, as Ryan was saying, you know, different people are coming out for different reasons. So everybody that I talked to at the protest was very clearly wanted it to remain peaceful. But again, you know, one person can change kind of the tone of an event. I did see one or two people throwing water bottles in the direction of the police, and there was definitely tear gas and pepper balls deployed. So,
and yesterday evening, I think late in the evening, a Molotov cocktail was reportedly thrown into a 7-Eleven near Romare Bearden Park. Can we anticipate that these protests, I only have 20 seconds, that these protests will continue today and into the week, Claire?
Yes, I would say yes.
Claire Donnelly from WFAE News, Ryan Pitkin from Queen City Nerve. Thank you both for joining us this morning. Just a recap of what happened this evening, or this weekend rather. Tomorrow we'll spend the hour talking with some of those involved in the protest to get their take on what they hope to accomplish, what they believe their efforts did accomplish, and where we go from here. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Now on to other aspects of what awaits us in a world rankled by racial tensions, political conventions in limbo, a constant flow of tweets from a president whose leadership is being questioned by almost everyone but his ardent followers, and the influence of COVID-19 on all of this. To help make sense of it all, we've invited Dr. Michael Bitzer to join us once again. He's the chair of the Department of Political Science and professor of politics and history at Catawba College. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Dr. Adolphus Belk is with us. He's political science professor at Winthrop University. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Whitney Ross-Monzo is associate professor of political science and assistant director of the Meredith Poll at Meredith College in Raleigh. Nice to have you back with us.
Thank you.
And Josh Putnam is a political scientist in Wilmington who runs the Front Loading HQ blog, which tracks the presidential campaign. You have time to join us for this? You're tracking the campaign? Good morning.
Here and there. Good morning. Okay. Thanks for having me.
I'd like to get really, really, really quick answers from all of you on this. I'm going to spend some time tomorrow talking about what made the killing of George Floyd different in ways that led to these mass demonstrations around the country. But I want to see if any of you believe that part of the reason for this nationwide reaction and venting of anger and frustration and despair is due in part just to the undercurrent of anger that seems to be fueling politics completely in this country. I'll start with you, Michael. Real quick answers from everybody. Go.
Yes, and I think that combine that with a global pandemic and the economic situation that the country is facing, this is just more gasoline on an already burning fire.
Whitney.
Yeah, I would agree with Michael. And I would say also that the constant news about the racial impacts of COVID-19 as well, and how people of color aren't being taken care of in that regard as well, also has, it's just added to already stressed out communities.
Adolphus Belk.
I think it was when he said that we've allowed a multitude of social evils to accumulate, and that each of these cities where demonstrations are occurring have their own lists of people who have been abused at the hands of law enforcement. And I think that's the context in which all of this has exploded.
Josh.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, not only do we have the pandemic, but we have the economic fallout from that. Add to it a kind of constantly simmering racial tension, and it's something of a perfect storm.
Adolphus Belk, all these demonstrations as they unfolded, and riots in some cities unfolded, some commentators on TV, and this actually occurred to me, said that it was reminiscent of what happened in 1968, another very troubled time in this country. Are there similar dynamics at work here, not just in the way these demonstrations and protests unfolded, but the underlying cause?
More damning than what we saw in 1968, because we've had time since then to get it right, and we haven't as a society. Some of the same social unrest of that moment, police brutality, joblessness, a lack of opportunity, poor education, poor health, those are the same things that are driving the current uprising. So I think in some ways history doesn't repeat itself, but it certainly rhymes, and things should have been better by now, but they're not for many.
In 1968, Michael, young people were angry, I think, at LBJ about the Vietnam War. That could have been prior to that. It might have been. I get them confused now. It's been so long ago. But they were angry at the police in 1968 for what happened during the Democratic Convention in the streets of Chicago, overreaction to protesters by Chicago police. They were angry, justifiably, about the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy. This time, an ongoing series of police shootings was the initial spark, but we also have a president who was said to have goaded people on. Rather than offering words of calm and assurance, President Trump tweeted this weekend, "When the looting starts, the shooting starts," which harkens back to the civil rights movement, and warned protesters in Lafayette Park across from the White House that they would be met by, quote, "vicious dogs," which also harkens back to Selma and the civil rights movement, if they scaled the White House fence. And he also said on Saturday, "My administration will stop mob violence and stop it cold." This is a man whose default reaction is to act in his own political self-interest. Would he be better served by taking a different tack this time, or would he be seen by his base as betraying them if he did?
I don't think the past 3.5 years, the president has shown us who and what kind of leadership he is portraying to the country. Normally, we would expect a president to make an Oval Office address, to attempt to at least try to calm the frazzled nerves of this country. That is what the power of one man's office can give, a sense of normalcy, acknowledgement of the intensity of the issues, and at least a herald call to say, we need to address these issues, we need to confront these racial problems, but violence is not the way. We have seen this president from time to time do the exact opposite of what a normal president and normal times in such chaotic times would bring. And I think he knows where his heart lies. He knows what he wants to achieve in his presidency. And I am not personally surprised by any of the actions or lack of actions that he has taken to this point.
The Washington Post wrote over the weekend that the president stayed safely ensconced inside and had nothing to say. As a matter of fact, they're reporting this morning at one point they put him in the bunker downstairs. Aside from tweeting about the fire and the dogs, he had nothing to say. That was by design, evidently. The Post reports Trump and some of his advisors calculated that he should not speak to the nation because he had nothing to say. That's from a senior administration official. He had no tangible policy or action to announce, nor did he feel an urgent motivation to try to bring people together, so he stayed silent. Meanwhile, Whitney, the president tweeted about what he saw as a lack of leadership in Minneapolis. He wrote, either the very weak radical left mayor Jacob Frey will get his act together and bring the city under control, or I will send in the National Guard and get the job done right. That tweet went out on 1 a.m. On Friday night. Put that into context with other presidents, Whitney. It sounds a little Nixonian.
I would say that you're exactly right. I think that Trump is using the traditional Republican stance on law and order. And he, in fact, tweeted that in all capital letters this weekend, law and order, which, as you noted, goes all the way back to Nixon and before that, which is why I think that he didn't want to say anything, because he knows that this law and order message plays exactly to his base. And he knows that these kinds of riots, well, I don't know if he knows, but maybe his political advisors know that these kind of riots tend not to help Democrats in the following elections. Peaceful protests do, but whenever there's rioting and looting, it ends up poorly for the Democrats at the next election. I don't know that that will be the case this time, because I think we're in unprecedented waters, but I think that that's part of their calculation. And that's exactly why he's tweeting, you know, blame the Democratic mayor, blame the Democratic governor. They're trying to lay this unrest firmly at the feet of the Democratic Party so they can capitalize in November.
The Democratic mayor of Minneapolis, Adolphus, seems to have done a masterful job in being apologetic and being on the side of the Floyd family and being on the side of the protesters. I don't think that Minneapolis, from the mayor's point of view, was served by a lack of leadership. But the president on, I think it was Thursday, it may have been, I get the days confused, retweeted a video from a supporter saying that the only good Democrat is a dead Democrat. The original tweet came from a New Mexico County Commissioner who was asked by CBS News what he thought of the retweet by the president. He said, it really means a lot to me because I know that the President of the United States has my back. What kind of president is this?
The kind that he's always been. When people show you who they are, believe them the first time, that this president is of a mindset that I'm trying to win an election and I'm going to dance with the people that brought me to the party. He believes that this is the type of behavior that's going to help him to shore up re-election for 2020. We also have to remember that this is a president who, shortly after being elected, said that he would reinstitute the wars on crime and drugs, who spoke before a large police audience and said that they need to rough up suspected criminals. And this is also someone that has made a number of statements over the years, both before and during his presidency, that gave you an indication of his politics when it came to crime and issues of imprisonment. He said that the Central Park Five should be executed for their crimes. And even after they were exonerated by DNA evidence, he commented that he believed that they still committed the crime. So whereas with the local level, we've seen some city officials and state officials trying to do things to bring their residents together to get to the core of the problem, we've seen something different from the president.
So, Josh, I'm just curious as to what this means for the presidential campaign ahead, since you follow the campaign, and what it might mean for a second term of a Trump administration in which he has beaten the rap on, what's the word I'm looking for?
Impeachment.
Impeachment, thank you. Beaten the rap on impeachment, and nothing seems to stick.
Well, if we look at the polls right now, we're getting some pretty significant consistency there, and it's pointing towards Biden doing quite well nationally. It's been a month or two since Trump was ahead in one of those polls. And at the in the states where it's going to matter in the fall, it's even more trouble potentially. But what this means for a second term is certainly speculative at this point. It's not looking promising at this point in time that's going to come to pass. But again, it would seemingly burn more bridges between him and those who would potentially enact policy with him. Should a second term come to pass.
The tweet that I referenced a minute ago and the retweet by the president of the only good Democrat is a dead Democrat did not catch Twitter's attention, Michael, but his tweet about mail-in voting did, and Twitter, in fact, added a check warning to two of his tweets over the weekend, and I think another warning was added to a third tweet. And that, of course, set the president off, and he threatened to shut down Twitter, saying Republicans feel that social media platforms totally silence conservatives' voices. Is there a scintilla of truth to that statement?
I'll be candid. I'm not an expert in that particular area of censorship on social media, but I will say that when he cites the First Amendment, the First Amendment's first five words say, "Congress shall make no law." It does not apply to private corporations and individuals of that nature. Now, the states also fall under the First Amendment guarantees of those liberties. But if Twitter, if Facebook, if Instagram, if other social media platforms choose to identify tweets that they believe violate their standards and their policies that users have to agree to before going onto such platforms, then they are within, I believe, their legal rights to do so.
So the next day, he signed an executive order, the president did, which would allow regulators to go after Facebook and Google and Twitter for how they handle content on their platforms. Right now, platforms are generally not liable for the material that other people post on them. But under this executive order, if it in fact is legal and goes forward, they would become liable. Wouldn't that work against the president, because he tweets things that are often false, he tweets things that are often incendiary, and wouldn't they be forced to take those posts down? Wouldn't he be defeating himself? Josh?
It certainly is not going to help matters at all, right, for the president, right? As I said before, right, he's burned some bridges with those he may work with in the future or try to work with in the future. But, you know, I mean, again, as several other folks have said during the context of this conversation, you know, the president has a Twitter problem, right? People have said that over and over again throughout the even stretching back to the 2016 campaign. That continues to be the case, right? And there's a something of a divergence between what we see on Twitter and some of the comments that the president has made publicly, but there's certainly a stark contrast in terms of the silence we're really getting from the president on a lot of these things.
Go ahead, Adolphus.
The president also has a credibility problem. Some data in April, he's made something like 18,000 false or misleading claims over the course of his presidency, and much of that has been put into the political atmosphere via Twitter. And as it regards to mail-in voting, there was a poll by the Gallup organization which demonstrated that the overwhelming majority of Americans, 64%, favor mail-in voting, 68% amongst independents, 83% amongst Democrats, but only 40% amongst Republicans. So something like mail-in voting has also become a partisan issue where Republicans believe that it hurts their chances of winning elections, and so they're opposing it. And we've seen that with a number of practices that could have opened up access to participation, from early voting to same-day registration. Those things have generally been opposed by Republicans, and in North Carolina, they've been undone by them.
Did you want to jump in there, Michael?
Yeah, I was just going to say, and what's surprising to follow up on Adolphus's comments is that here in North Carolina, Republicans benefit. Republicans lead in absentee by mail-in voting. It's been shown through the research that I've done, and I think Josh can also back me up on this, is that, you know, more registered Republicans utilize absentee by mail voting, and the candidates benefit as well. Only about 5% in the past of presidential election years have seen absentee by mail ballots. That's going to skyrocket, I think, this year.
Josh.
Well, right. And we're even beginning to see some anecdotal evidence of this in the context of this campaign. I read a piece last week about mail-in voting for the Pennsylvania primary tomorrow. And Republican leaders there are saying that they're afraid that some of the voters are going to follow the president's lead on this and not vote by mail. And may not show up at the polls tomorrow.
I want to point out that we're having this conversation via Zoom, and the only person without a camera this morning is Whitney Munza, so I can't see whether you want to jump in here and make a comment about that. Whitney, would you like to?
Yeah, sure. Well, as I don't have my camera on because internet bandwidth has been a struggle, which I think we all can relate to recently. But I just wanted to add that my favorite part of all of this is that these leaders who claim that they don't favor mail-in voting have all utilized mail-in voting themselves.
Have voted by mail themselves is what you're saying.
Right. Donald Trump has, right. Mitch McConnell has, Dan Patrick and Greg Abbott, who are the governor and lieutenant governor of Texas, who have claimed over and over again that they hate mail-in voting. They've both used it. So that little piece of irony is nice. Mail-in voting for me, but not for thee. And the other piece of it that I think is problematic is the tweets that Donald Trump sent about what he feared, like kids running in the street and stealing ballots from mailboxes. And it was almost like he was giving a list of activities that you should do, which I thought was very problematic.
Whitney Munza is with us. She's associate professor of political science at Meredith College and the assistant director of the Meredith Poll. We're also here with Michael Bitzer, Adolphus Belk, and Josh Putnam. We're coming right back. So much to talk about the upcoming presidential campaign.
On the latest episode of Inside Politics, a look at President Trump's threat to move the RNC from Charlotte. How many cities could hold the convention, and how many want to?
Not one city in Texas could give assurance to the RNC about our ability to pack an arena or to maintain social distancing.
Listen to the latest episode of Inside Politics, the RNC in Charlotte, on wfae.org/insidepolitics or wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with the chair of the Department of Political Science and History at Catawba College, Michael Bitzer. Adolphus Belk joins us from Winthrop University, where he's a professor of political science. Whitney Ross Munza, associate professor of political science at the Meredith College. And Josh Putnam, a political scientist based in Wilmington and a person who tracks the presidential campaign and publishes the Frontloading HQ blog. The presidential race, such as it is this time around, is going on against the backdrop of the worst pandemic in a century, the loss of over 100,000 American lives, and an economic crisis that is about to eclipse the Great Depression, levels of unemployment that have not been seen since the Great Depression, and now comments about China that threaten to ignite yet another Cold War in the world today. Whitney, if you were running the presidential campaign of Donald Trump or that of Joe Biden, where would you begin? What issue would you tackle first?
Oh, man, that's a tough one. I think right now, obviously, we're all focused on the issues of law enforcement treatment of people of color, particularly Black Americans. And so I think that Joe Biden has done well in at least releasing a couple of statements about, you know, pleas for calm, pleas for conversations. So I think any other message right now would seem a little tone deaf. But we also have an eternity until November. And so I think that, and we've learned in this presidency that every week there's something new that comes up. And so I think the first thing we need to tackle is the discussions around police forcing and the use of military gear by police forces. I mean, there's a whole lot of things that you can talk about with police brutality. And I think that's got to be first on the agenda. Otherwise, you just seem out of touch.
Michael, Joe Biden, it doesn't have the bully pulpit that the president, any president, has. And right now with COVID-19, he's not even out on the campaign trail because he can't be. He can't be making stump speeches. And so occasionally he will put out a video or a YouTube something or other that talks to people directly. What should he be doing in this situation, in this uncharted territory that we're going through right now? How do you campaign against an incumbent?
Well, I don't think you can do the normal things of campaigning, but what Joe Biden is doing is making himself available to anybody and everybody. He's going into different TV markets. He's going on national news networks. He's making himself available. And in fact, this past weekend, he went out to the community to talk to individuals, to share empathy, to show concern, more so than what the president has done. And so I think, you know, for all of us who are political scientists, we're going to basically be talking about the fact that the party you identify is typically the party that you're going to vote for. And that's going to be an overwhelming number of Americans who vote this year. So the die is pretty much cast. But what Joe Biden needs to do is be able to almost show the counterpart to what Donald Trump has done, and to show the empathy, to show the concern, to speak to the outrage, and to make it clear that his administration would do things very differently from what Donald Trump's administration has done.
Is it working? Because people have said that when he makes these statements on tape or on Facebook or whatever it may be that he's getting these messages out on, he looks a little addled from time to time. And there was even one that was played repeatedly in which at the very beginning he stumbled several times and they left it in. They didn't edit it out. They could have because it was on tape. And then you have the appearance recently, Adolphus Belk on The Breakfast Club, in which he said, if this is a paraphrase, if you vote for Trump, you ain't black. That didn't go over well with almost anybody in the country. He's since apologized for that. But what has been the reaction, and can you recover from that?
I think the recovery goes back to your initial question about what should he be doing. And I think, one, he should borrow a page from the book of George W. Bush in the 2000 campaign, where he talked about restoring honor and dignity to the White House following a number of controversies that involved the Clinton administration. I also think he should take a page from his president, Barack Obama, and make it about change, about leadership. All of the problems that you listed are symptomatic of a lack of leadership at the federal level of analysis. When you talk about confronting the economic downturn, confronting COVID-19, there was an entire playbook that was available that was jettisoned. So this is a issue of honor, decency, dignity, leadership. And you can use those social media platforms to connect with voters. Now, if we look back at the data from election 2016, in 2012, African-American voters surpassed white voters for the first time in this country's history in terms of voter turnout, and then that plummeted. Some of that might have to do with the things like voter ID and other requirements, but it also was a failure on the part of the Clinton campaign to engage African-American voters. Going on a Breakfast Club might help, but talking to people in that way will not. And if we connect the conversations about the election, COVID-19, the police brutality response, there are some clear policy issues that matter to African-American voters, and they need to speak to them in a way to say something other than we're not Donald Trump.
Is he doing that?
Not well.
Okay.
There's considerable room for improvement.
Oh, sorry, Adolphus.
That's okay, Whitney. Go ahead.
I would also say that Michael is right that a majority of Americans vote, you know, by the party that they identify with. But in this particular election, I've seen this time and time again. Even if people aren't excited about Joe Biden, they're really excited about going to vote Donald Trump out. And so I think that that's something that benefits Biden. You know, he still needs to try, but he has a captive audience here that of people who don't, you know, the Democrats could put up a lot of people and they don't really care who they put up as long as it's some they can go into the voter booth and vote Donald Trump out.
Josh, how important is Joe Biden's pick for vice president?
Well, we were talking about what Biden can do to get in the news, and I think that's one way that, that the campaign's been pretty effective at that is kind of stringing this vice presidential pick along, right? Airing it really in public, right? I read a piece this morning about how the recent events have kind of uprooted some of the thinking within the campaign about who he should go with. So that's been a really effective way of doing that, of keeping him in the news. Without him being up close and personal with people, without him making those video statements that we said before and what have you.
Well, it seems to me that
but it is an important pick.
And it seems to be even more important given his age. He's 78. You've got to pick a vice president who could take over on a moment's notice, which is it could happen. He's 78 years old. He'll be the oldest president in the history of the country if he wins election. Has he boxed himself in, Adolphus, by promising it will be a woman?
I don't think he's boxed himself in because there are plenty of women who are qualified to be vice president or president of the United States. The first woman to do so will not be the first woman that's qualified to do so. And if you talk about exciting women voters and Black women voters in particular, who are the most loyal constituency in the Democratic Party, it comes back to those policy issues. Some of the names that we've heard are Senator Harris from California, Representative Demings from Florida, though she's only been in Congress for about 4 years and she has not won a statewide election. And someone like Harris might be more appealing because she's won statewide elections as Attorney General in California and also as a United States Senator and has some real bona fides with African-American voters, though she didn't make it to the rounds of votings for the primaries and caucuses.
Whitney, nationally, I'm told in polls, Joe Biden leads Donald Trump 47-41%, but we keep being told we shouldn't be paying attention to national polls. We should be paying attention to polls in states where it really matters. Florida, a must-win state for Trump, shows Biden ahead 49-46%. In Michigan, one of the states that Trump won last time, Biden is ahead 49-43%. Wisconsin polls have Biden ahead 47-41%. In Pennsylvania, it's Biden 48, Trump 39. Biden is ahead by 1 point in Georgia, but in North Carolina, the two are tied, 46% each. And that figure comes from a compilation of polls. What did the May 1st Meredith poll indicate?
We found a lead for Joe Biden, although it was not a super strong lead. We found greater divergence among the Senate race in North Carolina, where a lot of people said that they preferred Democrat Cal Cunningham to Republican Tom Tillis. And so that actually is probably the more interesting question for me at the moment is how Trump's coattails will or will not help Republicans down ballot in the state. I'm sorry. The other really big race that the Democrat is clearly winning or should win is Roy Cooper. Roy Cooper's doing really, really well versus Republican Dan Forrest. And I think that goes down to, again, what we were talking about earlier, the leadership that he has shown. So I think the down ballot races in North Carolina are going to be really interesting.
Adolphus.
When we look at the outcome from 2012 to 2016, Mike, those states that you mentioned were states that were flipped by Trump. And in some of those states, the margin of victory was really narrow. So I come back to the point about engaging minority voters. Minority voting in Wisconsin dropped by 17% from 12 to 16. In Ohio, it dropped by 10%. In Florida, it dropped by 7%. And in North Carolina, it dropped by 12%. So you have a real opportunity here to flip those states if you're able to engage those voters and give them something to which they can say yes.
So, Michael, the president is not elected by the popular vote, as we have come to find out in recent elections. He or she is elected by the Electoral College. What do all these polls portend? Is this going to be another year where the Electoral College may go against the popular vote?
I mean, the current trend doesn't seem to me like it's going to, but we have to watch these states. We have to watch Wisconsin. We have to watch Michigan. We have to watch Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Florida. I would throw in states like Arizona, potentially, Georgia, potentially. I mean, I was hearing one political scientist at UGA that Josh and I know pretty well, Chuck Bullock, and he said Georgia is a toss-up at this point in time. And Georgia has been reliably Republican, much like North Carolina was reliably Republican until 2008, when it wasn't. So I think, you know, the national numbers, everybody tends to ooh and ah over, as I think Whitney would agree and others would agree. It's really the state numbers that we have to watch. And these campaigns are all about strategy in terms of who can get to 270 votes.
You just said that it's a toss-up in Georgia between Biden and Trump. He leads. Biden leads by a tiny, tiny margin at the moment in Georgia. Of course, there's lots of time between now and November. But Josh, you tweeted that, quote, if there is a uniform swing from 2016 to 2020, then a one-point Biden lead in Georgia would bring Florida, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin back into the blue column and push Arizona and North Carolina blue as well. Explain that, because I don't understand it.
Well, if you kind of rank order the states from most Democratic to most Republican in the last election, right, you've got an order that says that Georgia's closer to the Republican end of that spectrum, which means that states that are closer to the Democratic side, as we mentioned, North Carolina, Arizona, and the blue wall states Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin would all come back to the Democrats in that process. It's just a kind of a rank ordering, what I call it, or what I have on my site when I get this up and running in a week or two, but the Electoral College spectrum. It has been, as Michael said, a reliably Republican state. If that's a state that's going 1 point for Biden in the end, then the other states are likely to be blue as well, leading to well north of 270 electoral votes.
Dr. Bell.
Stacey Abrams came within about 50,000 votes of becoming the next governor of Georgia, and that was with a massive voter purge that was led by the gentleman who was the Secretary of State in Georgia, who also happened to be the winning candidate in the end, Brian Kemp. So things like that could indicate that Georgia's in play.
So Donald Trump was planning on running on the strongest economy the world had ever known, to use his words. That all went out the window with COVID-19. Initially, people were saying that Trump could not be blamed for this economic collapse because it's an act of God. But if details about his and his administration's handling of the run-up to the crisis show that he and his team dropped the ball on this, will that have an effect, Adolphus? And I ask because the two sides are kind of dug in and look immovable. His fans love him, and they're not changing, and vice versa.
If we look at a lot of the indicators that are coming into this, U.S. satisfaction is down, economic confidence has plummeted. You have about one out of every four Americans out of work. Over 40 million applied for unemployment benefits over the last month or so. Like, some of these numbers are really dire. And if we compare ourselves to nations like South Korea or Germany, they've done a better job of mitigating the public health crisis. In turn, the United States has treated a massive public health dilemma as a political one and has failed as a result.
And he's tried desperately to reopen the economy. He's been pushing governors around the country, including our own, to open the economy and get on with it. And Whitney, you conducted a poll of North Carolinians at the end of April that found that citizens here are very cautious about reopening. Do you know if that's changed since April? That was a month ago.
We haven't done a follow-up poll since, but there have been other polls. I was just reading about an ABC Washington Post poll that was released yesterday that said Americans are very wary of getting back out into the full economy. And I don't think that it's just fears either about potentially contracting the virus. It's also a matter of practicalities. How can people go back to work when schools are closed or daycares are closed? How can you go back to work when you have unstable internet connections and you have to be able to do your job via the internet, but some jobs can't be done via the internet? And so I think that there's a fear there for sure, but there's also just logistical problems with, quote unquote, reopening the economy. You can't just flip a switch.
Michael, I only have 20 seconds, but if governors reopen more quickly than medical experts are recommending and we do not experience a surge in cases, will people blame overly cautious Democrats for the economic collapse and vice versa? If we open too quickly and we do have a surge in cases, will they blame Donald Trump?
I think it's going to be partisan either way. And I think what this fall will bring is probably more so of a referendum, typically on an incumbent president seeking re-election. It's more about what he has done in the past 4 years.
Dr. Michael Bitzer, chair of the Department of Politics and History at Catawba College. Dr. Adolphus Belk, political science professor at Winthrop University. Whitney Ross Monzo, associate professor of political science at Meredith College. And Josh Putnam, political scientist and frontloadinghq.blog. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.